Okay, Howard.
Sorry about that. Okay.
That's all right, Howard, go on.
I'm unmuted now. Adam, you seem to be excluding the idea that any of the regimes that exist in the world today could reasonably be called fascist. So for example, I don't know, China, Cuba, Russia perhaps, Burma, Myanmar, and various other places, various other states where you've got some form of authoritarian rule or one party in charge, and others perhaps sort of outlawed or allowed to operate normally, excluding that, that those setups can reasonably be described as fascism, in the same way as it's being said nowadays that that's the kind of thing that Trump would like in America, to be a sort of dictator, whether it's true or not, or whether it's possibly happened. So can you sort of comment on that? Is it just a question of terminology that we can't call countries or regimes like that fascist? Or is there some qualitative difference between what happened there and what happened in Germany, Italy in the 30s?
Well, I think what that argument is doing is defining fascism as a one-party state. I mean, there are plenty of one-party states, and some of them ruled by the military, some ruled by civilian dictators. But I mean, fascism, it's historically wrong, I think. I mean, fascism was something that, as I was trying to explain, that emerged in between the two world wars of the last century, and it was something. Well, it was in the case of Germany, it was in an advanced industrial country. I mean, there's no chance of a fascist regime now occurring in Germany or Britain or France or America or Japan or New Zealand or Australia or something like that. So, I mean, the countries you're talking about are developing countries or backward countries, whatever you want to call them, which haven't got a strong capitalist class, and you've got these other people taking over, military dictators and things like that. But because in fact, we have done this. I mean, you'd have to call Russia fascist. I mean, Lawrence Weinberg always used to call them red fascists, and you could call. I mean, this just confuses everything. I think it's best to keep the term fascist to its historical context, because you could the other term which is used, of course, which could be used to mean general authoritarianism, is Stalinist. Stalinist fascist. I mean, both of them are sort of overused terms, which, in my opinion, are not helpful.
First of all, to mention, nothing to say in regards to Franco Spain, but my main comments being as to the historical phenomenon of fascism appearing in the political scene. I think it's pretty obvious. You don't see that phenomenon appearing again, because the circumstances, the political class no longer, capitalist class no longer exists. They are fully formed around the world. Therefore, there's no need for fascism. Correct.
Adam, do you want to come back on that?
No. I listen to what other people got to say.
Okay, yeah. Darren?
Hello. Okay, to maybe just bring it more into the here and now, I take on board what you're saying about the fascism as a historical phenomenon. Maybe we should broaden it out into, if you like, far right populism, which does exist today, which a lot of people rightly or wrongly are mislabeling as fascism, because that is a real issue for the working class. It is a real issue for socialists, because we can only put forward our ideas in like a democratic space, And if there are phenomenons like in, you know, like it was Orban in Hungary or Bolsonaro in Brazil, etc., there's lots of examples we can give where I feel like this right wing authoritarianism is becoming normalized, and unfortunately a lot of workers, a lot of people are kind of like accepting again as the norm. You know, maybe we should discuss that. Why is it, you know, arguably in the last few years there has been an increasing amount of workers who are kind of dismissive of just liberal democracy, political democracy, you know, and they are looking for the strong leader, they are looking for the authoritarian measures, they are again blaming the other, whether it be religion, whether it be race, color, etc. No, I mean, take on board what you're saying about fascism historically, but what about in the here and now? You know, if it's not fascism, fair enough, but it is a very ugly form of right-wing authoritarianism, which impacts on all of us, and you know, we have to address that. You know,
I thought I did actually in most of the talk. My argument was we shouldn't call them fascists, but they're still xenophobic, racist, ultra-nationalist, and we should still oppose them. Yes, of course.
Could I just come back on that?
Yeah, sure.
Quickly? I mean, one thing struck me. Yeah, just, I mean, here's an interesting thought. The word fascist, the label fascist, is bandied around so much. Everybody's political opponent is a fascist, etc., that it's obviously sort of infantilized political discourse and debate. You know, it's polarized, you know, people are not even prepared to discuss at this point. But in another way, do you not think that everybody being called fascist now, that it's almost like some people, it's almost like sanitized them? And fair enough, if we're not talking about fascism in its historic sense, I get the sense that people now are like, oh, calling me this because I have these opinions about X, Y, and Z, and you're calling me a fascist because of this. Maybe I am a fascist. No, I'm sorry if that's like a off-topic, but it has struck me that, like a lot of people, like in America, because I'm in the States, like what socialist and communist is back in sort of political discussion because it's used so much as a label that some people have turned in and said, all right, maybe I am a socialist. Converse of that is that some people have turned around, well, maybe I am a fascist. Or because they're an ethno-nationalist, or because they believe in like isolationism, or this kind of hatred of the people, and you know, even if fascism is a movement, you know, it isn't obviously the 30s. I think the here and now, this as a political label, it's kind of popular for a surprisingly and worrying amount of people, you know, and I wonder what other people's thoughts are on that, you know, not just Adam's, I guess.
But these various right-wing parties that have risen in Europe and throughout Europe now, none of them call themselves fascists. I mean, why not? If that was going to bring them support, they know that if they did call themselves fascists, they would lose support or they would split. And in fact, that's what happens if the real fascists who infiltrate them get any positions of power. They have to be expelled, and so I don't think that. I mean, people might think, "Ah, authoritarianism is a good idea," and government, but I don't think they want a one-party state, and I don't think they want something. They would call themselves fascists. You know?
Mike,
hello there. Yeah, very interesting talk. Yeah, thank you very much, and interesting discussion so far as well. And I suppose maybe following on from. Something that's been hinted at over the last couple of contributions is that the word fascist is a very emotive term, isn't it? You know, it's used by anti-fascists or non-fascists as a term of abuse. It carries a lot of emotion there. And, you know, that sort of got me thinking on sort of, you know, what kind of emotions are charged up in this debate. And, the word fascism conjures up it's associated with emotions like, you know, anger, hatred, jealousy, even you know, dislike of the unlike, and they're all very sort of, you know, powerful emotions which some people have. And of course there are powerful emotions on the opposite sides as well, you know, in a more positive way, you know, in some ways, you know, obviously the opposite of what emotions guide fascism. And so a lot of their so in some ways, you know, fascism is a temperament as much as a descriptor of a political ideology. And you know, of course, if you you know, as has been sort of discussed already, if you you know, challenge the ideology of fascism, that's quite easy to do in the sense in that, you know, they're fascist or racist or xenophobic or nationalist arguments are based on, you know, as Danny Lambert would say, you know, mistaken identity, you know, misinterpreting the facts, making assumptions on people of different groups. So yeah, the ideology is quite easy to challenge in a rational way, but of course that doesn't carry much weight with lots of people who could be described as fascists. You know, you wouldn't, it would be hard to imagine sort of picturing, you know, sitting down with a fascist and having a rational discussion and, you know, sort of picking apart their answers. And I'm you know, that is, you know, obviously the way to expose fascism's weakness. But I suppose my point was that, you know, the ideology can be picked apart rationally, but how do you, how do non-fascists or anti-fascists or revolutionaries challenge the emotion which drives fascism? That's something that's harder to do. How do you change someone's emotion? Yeah, I suppose you could argue that emotions supervene on ideology, and, you know, our emotions and our reactions to things are based on our, you know, our perception, our framework of the world. But so, yeah, I suppose my point was, or question was, you know, how do you tackle the non-rational, irrational, emotive aspects of far-right ideology? And that seems, you know, the sort of the nub of it, and also something which is harder to do in practice.
Thank you, Mike. Tim?
Yeah, hi Carla. Sorry, I missed the first few minutes. And I suppose I should tread delicately with this issue, because it wasn't long ago that one of our comrades tried to get me expelled from the party, suggesting that the American regime was fascist. And I'd say similarly for the UK and others. What I may have missed at the beginning was a definition of fascism from an objective point of view, from a criteria point of view. What I heard Adam say was illustrate fascist, the fascist system in a historical context. And in fact, he did more than that. Towards the end, Adam, you actually stated that fascism should be kept in its historical context. And for me, that's one of the biggest dangers, which is why I, not gratuitously or in a hyperbolic way, but talk about fascism in the current context. Because if we treat it as in an historical aberration, then we're never going to recognize in contemporary society. And if we simply describe it as a manifestation in history, rather than its constituent parts, its objective constituent parts, then we'll never recognize it again in contemporary society. And it seems to me, if you look at the constituent parts of fascism, the most important part, then they all exist in today's society. That's today's society in the United States, in the UK, predominantly, but in other regimes, in Russia, in Brazil, and so on and so on. And that's the biggest danger, it seems to me. And I assume that in the 30s, you know, the sort of intelligentsia, something similar, really. They just refused to recognize the dangers of fascism. And it seems we're going to suffer the same fate if we don't do that. So, for example, I agree, Adam, with you know, wholeheartedly with the idea of being disparaging about the tactics of Antifa and
any violent sort of backlash against fascists or no platforming. You know, I think that's abhorrent. But more important, by standing up for free speech, freedom of speech and freedom of action, freedom of movement, that then denies one of the constituent parts of fascism. And we've lost that as well. We've lost that. So again, from my point of view, that constituent of fascism in place, but all the others are in place as well.
Well, I didn't say fascism was a historical aberration. I said it was a historical fact. And I mean, the historical fact was, or one of them, was that the world had already been carved up by France and Britain, and Germany wanted to have a place in the South. That's a historical fact, and that led, in fact, to two world wars. And the ideology of the German capitalism in the end, well, it wasn't, was Nazism. I don't think that situation is going to occur again. Now, to give you another example of historical things, when the Communist Party and people were trying to understand fascism, Trotsky said it was Bonapartism. Now, who knows what Bonapartism is today? I mean, it's just something that was peculiar to France at a particular time, and nobody talks about it again. But it was a similar sort of thing as to some regimes that exist in the world today. But I think that the main reason that I would say for not calling present day political states fascist is that it blurs the distinction between political democracy and fascism. I mean, there is a difference between the two, and we have a system at the moment which does allow meetings like this, which does allow us to organize as a party to contest elections and other people to do this. I mean, it isn't fascism. Whatever the, obviously, capitalism is a hierarchical society and there's authoritarianism. It isn't a fascist political regime at the present time in Britain or France or Germany or even in America. So to describe the present political setup as fascism, I think is wrong. I think it's even dangerous, because it has the opposite effect as the people downplaying the significance and importance of having political democracy as the framework within which the socialist movement can best develop.
Paddy?
I'm wanting to agree with Adam just on this point about fascism as, you know, as a historical phenomenon. I think one of the things that, well, I'm not sure if you mentioned it, Adam, but it seems to me that one of the key things about that period was that fascism was in part a response to the Red Scare, and we don't really have a Red Scare today. So I think that without the one, you probably won't get the other. That's to say, that's to talk about fascism in its kind of historical form. But I do want to sort of suggest that actually maybe that we're probably talking at cross purposes when we talk about right-wing fascism or left-wing Stalinism or Bonapartism. The particular ideology that's involved in it that Mike Foster was talking about, I think the ideology is pretty irrelevant, actually. What we're talking about really is totalitarianism. We're talking about the all-powerful state. And it doesn't matter what the ideology is that drives the creation of the all-powerful state. It could be anything. It's irrelevant. It could even be a perfectly rational aim. What I'd quite like to ask, and this is where I'm sympathetic to what Tim's saying, is that we don't actually know what the conditions of the future might produce. Take, for example, that we've got potentially unlimited state surveillance. We've got an increasing fragmentation of class consciousness into micro bubbles and identity politics. We've got ever greater concentrations of wealth and power, more than was ever the case in the 1930s. And given these modern circumstances, is it possible that liberal capitalism as we know it isn't the last gasp of capitalism before it gives way to socialism, but is in fact the last gasp of liberal capitalism before it gives way to neo-totalitarianism? And if that's not the case, what are the forces in the future that, besides workers' solidarity, obviously, and socialist solidarity, what are the forces in society that are going to prevent that happening? I think that's getting more to the nub of what Tim's talking about.
But we've had an example over the weekend of the limitations of what a state can do. I mean, they don't want people to go to the beaches. People go to the beaches. They don't want people to hold street parties. People hold street parties. And they're saying, we haven't got enough police to stop this happening. So, I mean, an all-powerful state, I don't think capitalism could work on that basis. So, in fact, what prevents that happening is that there's people won't put up with it. People won't put up with it. People accept that their politicians should be elected. They accept that people should have free speech. So I don't think that's on the agenda. In fact, what you said was a popular ideology between the wars, where people were saying totalitarianism. There were books written by people on the left. I mean, Bruno Rizzi wrote a book called The Bureaucratization of the World. James Byrne wrote a book called The Managerial Society, which was saying this is the way the world is heading. It's heading towards what they've got in Russia, what they've got in Germany. This is the future, and quite a few left wing groups of the time said this. The future is state capitalism, private capitalism finished. State capitalism is the future. If we don't have socialism, what happened? I mean, it didn't happen, did it? I mean, you had this reaction against even mild labor reformism when Thatcher came to power, and all the reforms of the post-war Labour government were most of the reforms of the post-war Labour government were reversed, and you had the dominant capitalist ideology was the free market, and the people regarded as the right wingers, anarcho-capitalists and so on. I we're not in the same epoch as before the war, and I don't think, as I say, I said before, that you could run a modern capitalist basis on the capitalist economy, a capitalist country, on the basis of totalitarianism. You just can't. It has to be based on a degree of a consent, and I don't think people will consent to having secret police and so on doing, arresting people and torturing them and so on.
Can I just quickly come back on that? I mean, you'd have said that 30 years ago, and it would seem logical. But one of the most successful capitalist countries in the world right now is China, and I think that possibly changes the argument. I don't think you can anymore say we wouldn't see that sort of society in the future because people wouldn't put up with it. The Chinese are putting up with it, and there's no sign of that regime collapsing.
We don't know yet, do we? But we'll see. People of Hong Kong don't seem to like it.
Okay, Dougie?
Yeah, I'm listening to the debate. It's quite interesting. But I think sometimes it comes from cultural things, nationalism and religion. If you look at somewhere like Burma or whatever, you've got like a totalitarian regime that tried to get rid of the Muslims or whatever, and that was supposedly Buddhist, and that's not supposed to hurt flying, never mind hurt a Muslim or whatever. And you get that happening in the world. And a lot of fascism comes from nationalism, really, a feeling that this country's superior to every other. Our culture's the best. We had the best science or the best literature or the best music. And a feeling of nationalism can lead to some sort of totalitarian views or whatever. And I can take on board what Adam's saying, that most Western countries like Britain and America, it's very unlikely that they'll go fascist. But there are some instances of countries where you could say people are behaving, you know, especially in Burma or somewhere like that, against other religions or whatever. And religion and culture plays a large part in people's identity, and nationalism plays a large part in people going for authoritarianism, which is what you've got in Russia. You know, you've got the Orthodox Church, and you've got Putin, who wants to remain in charge until he dies, the way things are going, right? You know, so and you've got China, which is an authoritarian society. I mean, yeah, before the Second World War, you had Japan, people in Japan thinking they were superior to every other culture and they could invade China and they could do this and that. So, I mean, a lot of it's to do with nationalism. It's to do with cultural identity that people feel that they can support something like fascism, really. You know? So you've got to break down nationalism in this cultural identity. I mean, in Israel, some people think, you know, that they've got eternal rights to land and, you know, like Jerusalem and things like that because it's in the Bible and all the rest of it. So you've got religion and culture and nationalism, which is a heavy mix that causes societies to behave in abominable ways. And that's still going on today. Okay, you don't have Hitler and you don't have Stalin, but you've still got authoritarian regimes, which is based on culture and nationalism and nationalist identity.
You know, I did hint that was a part of the mix which led to fascism and Nazism, and that both Italy and Germany were recently established unified states. But a lot of the states we're talking about were ex-colonial states. I mean, the borders between them are artificial, and people are not a homogenous group, either culturally or linguistically or by religion. So a recently established state has to try and impose nationalism on to try and create the people that they rule over do form a nation. So some of these countries we've been talking about, that's what's I mean, you know that's what's going on. They're actually nation building. They're trying to instill into the population that they rule over the idea that they are you know, one nation, you know, when they're not, which I suppose has certain things in common with what Italy and what Germany did in the 1920s, 1930s. They've been going, what, 50 years as a unified state by then. But some of these other states, it's about the same period, isn't it? I mean, I don't know when Burma got independence or in the 1950s, I think. So they're comparatively recently established states compared with Britain and France and Portugal and Spain. So I mean, that would be something they would have in common with the you know, pre-war regimes in Italy and Germany.
Vin?
Yeah, thanks, Adam. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I wrote Q about 20 minutes ago, and the discussion's gone on there. And what I was thinking was, we're describing, trying to come up with kind of a definition of fascism. I just wanted to shove something in the mix of Umberto Eco, who grew up under fascism, and as a semiotician, he tried to define it, and even then he couldn't. I'm just going to copy. I'll copy the he wrote a piece in the New York Review of Books on Earth Fascism, where he gives 14 definitions of you know, how you know you're getting near a fascist state, and many of these are things that we've discussed, like tradition, nationalism. Anyway, I'll put it up, and if people want to follow the link, I find it quite interesting.
Okay, thanks for that, Vin. Tim, do you want to come back?
Yeah, thanks. Just on my couple of points. On the historical perspective, I would definitely concede that we should not conflate fascism with Nazism. And I'm quite happy to leave Nazism in the in the unique historical context that it is. Paddy made a wide-ranging point about, you know, trends and how to try and steer trends in a particular direction. But I mean, the classic thing is fascism's been seen as the last refuge of capitalism, isn't it? So from the party's point of view, it may not concur exactly with that, but I mean, it sees fascism as a sort of the links with fascism and socialism, it seems to me, are the necessity to have the bulk of the working class behind it. But I think that's the common aspect. I don't know why they called National Socialists the Nazis, but it seems to me that's the common aspect. And that links with populism and nationalism that he was referring to. That's a phenomenon that I think we need to be careful with. And it seems to me that, you know, if we see capitalism in its dying stages, then the phrase "the last refuge of capitalism" is a particularly important and poignant one. And it seems to me if you observe trends, you would observe the fascism that I believe exists now as a desperate time for capitalism to hang on to the economic system. And as Paddy's suggesting, if it's not going to go in that direction, where populism, massive working class support towards fascism, then how is it going to go in a different direction that seems unlikely at the moment by observation, which is mass popular support, populism, working class support for socialism? So, Adam, have you got any view about that sort of dichotomy in potential scenarios going forward?
But I mean, I was going to comment on something you said earlier, because the how fascism sort of gets into sort of left wing terminology is the pre Second World War Communist Party. Their analysis of fascism was similar to what you just said, that fascism is the policy of big business, finance capital, and it's as you say, it's last defense against Bolshevism, against what they call communism. But so that sort of framed the debate. Fascism is something to do with the defense of capitalism. Now it's true. I think Paddy mentioned this that the Red Scare. So what you had, between the wars, was a section of the ruling class which was prepared to allow a dictator to come to power. And I think I tried to point out in my talk that both Mussolini and Hitler came to power constitutionally. Now, I can't see that happening. Again, I don't think that the trends that we're seeing and that you're pointing out do point towards let's define fascism as totalitarianism. I don't think that they are doing that. And even the people that for instance, in the debate over Brexit, the slogan that won them was "take back control." It wasn't install a strong man or a strong woman to rule. It was even that has some sort of democratic content that people don't want to be bossed around by others and so on. So I mean, I think you're misreading the situation. I don't think it's going to happen. Basically, I don't think fascism will be the last, or some authoritarian regime will be the last refuge of capitalists. More likely to be the other way around, actually. As the socialist movement grows, the capitalists might well offer all sorts of concessions of a democratic or social nature to try and buy it off. You can speculate either way.
So, anyone else would like to raise anything, or
can I just put one more thing in Adam, which you know we've discussed before, but one of the things when I was being disciplined for using fascism, or considered to be disciplined, you illustrated that, and you have tonight, by saying that one of the characteristics, I'm not by any means the most important, I don't think, but one of the characteristics relevant to fascism is the one-party state. And you said then, of course, we don't live in a one-party state, so you can't describe the UK as fascism. But I thought the party's case was that we lived in a one-party state.
Well, you mean all the parties represent the capitalists? In that case, why do they have different political parties? I mean, that's quite apart from parties could represent different sections of the capitalist class. It's to their advantage to have competing parties. Okay, you know, I mean, that's not the same thing. Even if they all do stand for capitalism, that's not the same thing as saying that they're fascist. I don't know. Incidentally, if you're bringing up this thing, one of the things you said was that, you know, Madame Thatcher was a fascist, and no, it wasn't Madame Thatcher. Well, it wasn't even that. It was Theresa May. It was a fascist. Which I mean you know, that I don't think that view can be either view can be defended. Either whatever she's called, Theresa May or Madame Thatcher could be described as fascist.
I speak, Carla.
Yeah, Howard. Yeah.
Okay. Isn't what we've just seen written on the screen above IQ sort of argument against the kind of thing that Tim is saying? I won't say much more about what's written there, but if those of us who know what I understand it now, I didn't understand it before, I do now. I mean, isn't that a sort of argument against the idea that all sort of modern, what in the party we'd normally call capitalist democracies, democracies, that they're all basically sort of the same, and the same as other parts of the world where you've got systems that seem far less democratic. For example, the one that's referred to there. I mean, I think Tim talked about the constituent parts of fascism. I mean, surely, if you're talking about constituent parts of the way a system works, there is a significant difference between what's described there on the screen and what we've got in this country. It's not great. I know we could get vade and so on. We might have somebody, who knows, listening now from one of the intelligence organizations, but nevertheless, it's not quite the same as having to sort of write a message at the end of which you put, "Do not respond, please."
Yeah, exactly what I was going to say. Reading that, what kind of state, Adam, would you describe this then?
Well,
kind of state would you describe this?
There are plenty of states in the, I mean, they're all authoritarian states. I mean, you know, in Russia, they've had an election. But I mean, okay, maybe it's not under fair conditions, but there are still in a place like Russia and in other countries bordering on Russia, there is still an opposition which is allowed to contest elections, and which sometimes wins control of local councils and so on. They're not completely totalitarian countries. You can't call them ideal capitalist or political or bourgeois democracies, but they're not. They're not fascist in the get back to the historical definition of what fascism is. You know, and they're not Stalinist either. You know, they might be on the way there, but they can't go the whole way for various reasons, or they don't think it's necessary to go the whole way. I think in Russia, for instance, I think we could exist, and there are anarchist and syndicalist groups there.
Paul?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, I don't suppose you could describe the UK as fascist by any stretch of the imagination, nor could you do the same with America. But as far as that nutcase Trump goes, do you think it'd be fair to describe him as a fascist? Certainly not his administration or the country, but would you describe Trump as a fascist, Adam?
No, but I mean, he's appealing to a certain section of the working classes, which could be, if you like, might be exaggerating a bit, you know, white supremacists. You know, they've got the black population there, but it's only 15% of the population. He's trying to cash in on a backlash against that. So I mean, I don't think he's a fascist. I mean, I've seen stuff which says, you know, if he loses the election in November, he's going to refuse to leave the White House in whenever he has to leave in January. But I think that's already some American generals said to him, look, you can't, we're not going to let you use the army to put down these demonstrations. So I don't think even if he did have the illusion of becoming a dictator, he could get away with it. He wouldn't. I mean, and I think as well, also the America is more of a federal state than we sometimes imagine. The states there have got considerable powers even on law and order. You know, so I would describe him as a loud mouth. You know, but he's a populist. He realizes if he's going to get reelected, he has to get voted. He has to be reelected. Has people have to vote for him. You know, I don't know whether the people most Trump supporters are want a dictatorship. I mean, they're probably against giving more social reforms in favor of black people. They probably are, you know, white nationalists or something. A lot of them.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks for that, Adam.
Tim, are you coming back with something?
Yeah, I mean, I just wanted to clarify my description of Theresa May as a fascist. I mean, I describe her as a fascist, and I would describe Trump as a fascist, just as I describe myself as a capitalist. Because I think we're talking here not about a personal political ideology or even an ideology. I think we're talking about a political system. And so in as much as Theresa May facilitates that political system and Trump does the same in America, and I believe that system is fascist. So that's how I describe as fascist. I mean, Trump doesn't have the ideologies and, you know, anything, a capitalist sort of through and through, and, you know, businessman. And Theresa May probably didn't have that ideology either. But fascism, I don't see as primarily an ideology. It's a political system that can be objectively defined. So, for example, if I had to rank order the fascist criteria, I'd see the main fundamental aspect of fascism is the fusion of the state with the corporate sector. And I think if you look historically at Nazism, that was a fundamental characteristic of Nazism, which was in itself a fundamental characteristic of fascism. It seems to me it's undeniable that that is the case in the UK and America and most other Western countries, and well, most countries really. What would you say about that, Adam?
Well, I think you're having a play on the word corporate. I mean, the ideology of Italian fascism was the corporate state. In other words, that the decision-making body wouldn't be elected by universal suffrage. It would be elected by corporations from various industries. I mean, Mussolini himself, before the First World War, had been a left-wing firebrand, a syndicalist on the syndicalist wing of the Italian Socialist Party. So I mean, that type of corporate state that was envisaged by classical capitalism is not the same thing as the state today, being involved or pursuing the interests of capitalist corporations. It just happens to be that the word is the same. Obviously, if you're a government under capitalism, you've got to put conditions for making profits first, and that's what they do, and that's normal. But the states don't do exactly what corporations want to do. They just one of the more powerful pressure groups operating on them. I don't think you could say we've got a fusion of the state and corporations. What you've got is a state acting in the interests of corporations, because they're running capitalism, and corporations are enterprises or companies are profit-making institutions.
Saying that fascism is an episode in history that is gone, are you saying that can never happen again? Is that what you're saying, that can never happen again?
I'm not saying it can never happen again. No, I'm saying it's unlikely. But I think I'll go back to the example I gave before of Bonapartism in France in the 1850s and 60s. Fascism came about in the form that it did, and got the reputation. The word came into being with the reputation it has because of the specific situations in Europe at that time. And I don't think that is going to be recreated. And one of the conditions was, as has been mentioned before, that there were some sections of the ruling class that, given a choice between Bolshevism and they were prepared to abandon liberal democracy just to have their property protected. I mean, you could speculate if you want to go even further. I think if Hitler had won the war, there would have been a de-Hitlerization, just as there was a de-Stalinization. They'd have got rid of him and moved towards a system where they're, because if the capitalist class surrenders political power to group of politicians, these politicians can then start siphoning off some of their profits for their own benefit, which of course is what happened in Nazi Germany. But I take Tim's point that by fascism he doesn't mean Nazism. I don't think it can happen again in Europe now.
Okay, could I come back on that?
Yeah.
Okay, you don't think it can happen, but obviously you said that the conditions that brought up fascism, I agree, that could possibly, it would be different now.
Yeah.
But talking of the conditions under fascism, the conditions that workers, that the public had to endure, yeah. I mean, are you saying that could never happen again? And then what would you call it then? What would you call that then, if we had to endure the same conditions, regardless of how it arose?
Well, you know, another name will occur for it. I mean, But what are the conditions you're talking about, with trade unions being banned, other political parties being not allowed opponents, political opponents being rounded up and put into concentration camps? I mean, is that what you're envisioning as a possible scenario? I mean, I don't see that happening in the developed capitalist countries, frankly.
It'll probably be a lot more subtle than that, Adam, I think.
Well, I don't know. I mean,
I think we'll use a lot of psychological warfare type stuff. Anyway, yeah. Thank you. I think Mike wants to come in.
Hello again. Thinking about the sort of the timeline, if you like, of fascism and fascist tendencies according to, you know, sort of conditions at the time, you know, whether in the 30s or now, and, you know, obviously, you know, thinking on about the future. I was just wondering if the future of fascism might be eco-fascism, if the concerns about the environment or, you know, global warming accelerate and controls have to be put on, you know, individual lifestyles or production or transport as a response to an impending environmental catastrophe looming. And I suppose, you know, in the current pandemic situation, certain restrictions on how we live have been put in place, staying inside, not just nipping out to the beach or whatever, which in a different context and for different reasons, make you think of a fascist state. The word fascism hasn't been used to describe, you know, the social controls in the current situation, because, you know, everyone understands, or nearly everyone understands, the reasoning behind them. But again, you know, in the future, you know, if the threat is not from a pandemic, It's from environmental collapse, and that imposes what people would accept as reasonable controls on living for reasons which are, you know, not to do with the rise of a, you know, a political party, but sort of imposed sideways, if you like, through the environment. So, I was just wondering if that is how fascism will reinvent itself in the future, according to future material conditions.
But I mean, the word eco-fascism is already in circulation and has been used to describe certain, you know, point of view of people who are concerned about the environment. I think, I don't know, eco-fascism isn't quite as bad as using the word fascism. But who's going to impose it? I don't think it would be the people like Mussolini or Hitler. It'd be more like, what's his name, the Extinction Rebellion man, Roger Hallam, and people like that would want to establish an authoritarian regime which would restrict people's freedoms and I mean that's a theoretical possibility. I think we discussed that in a previous talk about what would happen if capitalism couldn't continue economically. What would the alternatives be? I mean, that would be one of them, I suppose, but. Well, how likely is that as well? But I think, eco-fascism is not so bad as fascism. I mean, as a word, I'm talking about. But it would be the leaders of the Green Party that would do it, wouldn't it? Tommy Robinson.
Would anyone else like to ask a question? Make a comment?
Perhaps it's something to do with Scientology. just a question for anyone actually, whether you know who's behind. I've got a leaflet called Football Lads and Lasses Against Fascism for United Working Class. And I just wondered if anybody knows who's put this up, because at the end of one of it, it's like... It's obviously some sort of trot organisation that doesn't want to admit its existence. Has anybody come across it? Football Lads and Lasses Against Fascism.
Hello, Steve. It's not a front organisation. It's basically if anything, I don't know if people remember, a few years back there was an organization called the Independent Working Class Association, which came out of Red Action. It was basically people sort of establishing like class politics on sort of council estates, etc. And I've got a feeling that some of the people involved in Football Lads and Lasses Against Fascism involved in possibly have roots in that. It's obviously a response to the far right, who've organised around sort of football casuals and football supporters last few years. It's just, I don't pretend to know a lot about them, but as I say, the people who kind of like out their stuff on social media are the same people I've seen in the past who have like been part of Independent Working Class Association. I really can kind of give you a concise explanation of what their politics are. You know, if you just type in I'm sure their website's still up somewhere. They elected some councillors in the Blackbird Leys estate in Oxford, and they contested elections in London. This would maybe be like 20 years ago, and these people are still sort of knocking around. It's just people, it's like just, you know, anti-fascists trying to sort of contest the ground of football supporters, because otherwise far right are going to sort of have the voice, they're going to make the running amongst football supporters. So not a front organisation, not Trotskyists. That's what I'd say.
Yeah, there was a discussion on this on the party's website forum. There was a news item in a Welsh paper that the other side, the Tommy Robinson supporters were coming out to defend a statue, I think, in Manchester, and they were attacked by a group of fans from Wrexham, who were well, anti-fascists. But so that, and then somebody put up about a German football club. I don't know, Dan will know about it. It's St. Pauli.
Yeah, St. Pauli in Hamburg. Yeah.
So I mean, that's the sort of people that we might be involved. Yeah.
There's a whole culture. There's a whole ultra culture. Ultras culture in Scottish football, in football supporters. You know, some are right wing, some are left wing. I was just reading a recent thread on a discussion list. You know, there's like certain football clubs which have a left wing tradition of ultras. You know, ultra supporters like Roma, Marseille, Glasgow Celtic, Wrexham. As Adam mentioned, there's a non-league team in London called Clapton FC. And yeah, as I say, they're just, FC United, some people know about FC United. It's just groups like that, who basically just like rooted in sort of left-wing politics, if you like. Some are anarchists, some are, primarily they're anti-fascist, So, as Adam mentioned, there was the statues business where the far right tried to mobilise a lot of football, like far right football supporters were going to sort of defend statues. And as Adam mentioned, apparently the Wrexham ultras turned up and beat the crap out of the far right ultras in Manchester.
Of course, the far right's reply was these people who support the IRA. I suppose Celtic do, I don't know.
I'm not answering that question as a Celtic supporter.
Quite right too, yeah.
Plead the fifth.
Anyone else? Adam, would you like to add anything? Or?
No, I just wanted to start a discussion on the use of a good discussion, which all points of view have been expressed. Anyone we didn't address was the one of... Mike, about the psychology of fascism, but I don't know, I'm not a psychologist. I'm a trick cyclist.
I guess psychology would be, for instance, as it was mentioned kind of with this COVID thing, we're told we're to do as we're told because it's for our own good. And I think they even used that in Germany when they wanted the public to do something. It was for their own good or it was for their health. So everyone complies because we think that that's the truth.
No, I mean, one time in the 70s and 80s, Wilhelm Reich's book, The Mass Psychology of Fascism, was popular in left-wing circles. And he blamed it on the way people were brought up, as kids in Germany. Some people have turned that into as if it was called the mass psychology of capitalism. I mean, there'll be members here who will remember that book by Wilhelm Reich was popular amongst some party members, to do with sexual repression. I think. Don't know whether there's any truth in it, mind you.
Well, I suppose on that point, yeah, Reich's view on sort of mischanneled sexual energy, that there's a lot of sort of testosterone flying around among the far right. I suppose there probably would be a Freudian interpretation of that. I don't know enough about it to sort of say any further on that one. But I've got a bit of a soft spot for Reich, and I've sat in one of his orgone accumulator machines.
What happened?
I felt a bit claustrophobic and got out again. But that's beside the point.
Kevin?
Okay,
I suppose I'm one of these people who read The Mass Psychology of Fascism, and indeed I read it in the 70s, although Reich, of course, died in the 50s in prison because, he was in prison because he was selling unlicensed medication, you know, when he was selling his orgone box as the answer to everything. I think he has a lot of things to say, but pretty much, yeah, it's pretty much of his time in the 50s. But in terms of psychology, you know, the sort of the book I would talk about is Moravia's The Conformist. I believe they made a film of it, but that's describing the inner workings of a fascist. Very interesting book, and I thought it was insightful.
I mean, I read William Reich's book. He was very much against homosexuality. That is a fascist aberration or whatever. So he was against that. And some of the things he said were a bit crazy. You know, the organo machine or the machine that causes orgies or whatever. So, I mean, he can be taken with a pinch of salt, really, you know, his views on homosexuality. And he pointed out to leading figures in the Nazi Party who were homosexual. And he was very much against homosexuality, which was a bit stranger.
Yes, I agree. Homosexuality was due to the fact we're living under capitalism. And having to have this character armor and all that business. What I was going to say is that I remember it again in the 70s. God, I'm an old man. I remember a trot coming to talk about Reich, and they didn't half over egg the pudding. You know, capitalism was responsible for cancer, and you know, if we don't, you know, once we get socialism, you know, no one's ever going to die of cancer anymore because we won't have this character armor that we build from birth. So I just sort of like as a two-penneth, just the left. I don't know whether the sort of Marxist-Leninists still feel the same about Reich, but they don't have. I think there are, you know, there are things that are useful. The idea of character armor is sort of interesting, but. You know, I think, he does over-egg the pudding. You know, socialism, you know, is going to solve a lot of things, but it's not going to cure cancer. Although socialists will, maybe.